Governor Holcomb unveils his 2020 agenda, a peek into Curtis Hill's pocketbook, plus a new contender in the race for Attorney General, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending December 13th, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Governor Eric Holcomb rolled out his 2020 agenda, which includes raising the smoking age and passing a hands-free driving law. Health groups and the Indiana Chamber of Commerce have long pushed to raise the legal smoking age to 21 without luck. Holcomb says the sharp spike in vaping among young people helped convince him to push for the change now.
It's just horrifying to me that sixth graders are now vaping consistently, are addicted to nicotine.
Holcomb won't yet call for a ban on flavored vaping products, as other states have, because he says he doesn't want to punish people who are trying to find a deterrent to smoking. The governor also wants to ban Hoosier motorists from using their cell phones while driving unless they're hands-free. He says the crash risk for distracted drivers is more than 3.5 times greater. Is this a bold agenda from the governor? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, is this a bold agenda from Eric Holcomb?
Is that a serious question?
It absolutely is a serious question.
That was my guess on your response, by the way. You always have, there's like three of them, I guess.
When you look at the state and you look at the fact that we have a crisis in education, we have a crisis in health care, we have some of the most expensive health care in the country, on all of the measures of the success in terms of the quality of life and the health of the people, we're down at the bottom. Voter turnout, we're down at the bottom. And this is the kind of agenda he comes up with. Fine, raise the smoking age to 21. That's great, okay? But if you want to stop smoking and you want to stop vaping, tax it, okay? Make it cost prohibitive, because I think you're going to have as much success enforcing a 21-year-old ban on smoking as you've had all these years on enforcing a 21-year-old ban on drinking. It's going to happen anyway. But if you tax it, you raise the revenue to treat it, And that's a bold position. I mean, when we hear the next level, which we've heard ad nauseum since he's been in office, I keep saying that his levels are like Lego blocks, and they are. I mean, we have serious problems in Indiana, serious problems. And while I agree that smoking and driving while texting are serious problems, it doesn't begin to scratch the surface of things he could be doing with supermajorities, and he's not.
Could this be bolder from Eric Holcomb then?
You know, I think this agenda, you look at it, and people are going to see it. If it passes, people are going to experience this in their daily lives, whether it's texting while driving or bringing the 2-1-1 human service partnership inside state government, so it's a one-stop shop for people that have any number of kind of human service needs. I think you're going to see people that understand very easily this improves how state government works, improves people's exposure and access to state government. If you want to talk about healthcare costs, there's some good things in here that follow the study over the summer that show that we do have, in fact, in central Indiana, some of the highest hospital costs in the country. So the governor's bringing transparency to those costs so they can next year bring reforms to that. There's reforms on surprise
next
billing.
Next year or the year
to affect surprise billing. So if you go into a hospital that you believe is in your network, but you see a provider that you didn't really know about who was out of your network, and then you get a full bill for it, there's a real problem nationwide. Congress is looking at it but hasn't been able to come to a total agreement on it yet, although they're getting close. These are big deals for people, and they're real problems that legislators are hearing about, which is why I think you've seen House and Senate Republican leaders aligned behind this agenda. I think you're going to hear a lot of the same proposals being advanced by legislative leaders, which is important because this is a very short session, which is why any criticism of an agenda not being big enough, well, you've got about 10 days in January to get something moving, right? And that is, just from a pipeline standpoint, it's hard from a procedural standpoint because this session's only intended to pass things that people
that
care about.
Tough.
Well, this is not done in a vacuum. This is a 2020 agenda that also happens to be an election year for Eric Holcomb. Is there anything you see in here that jumps out to you as potentially risky for him?
Not necessarily, and I think that, for the most part, is by design. This agenda is really not unusual if you look at what he has sought to do in the General Assembly in the past.
Nothing.
As I have said before, you call it nothing. I say it's the good government. It's the manager. I'm at the helm. We're going to fix what's broken. We're going to make government work better. We're going to ensure that the services that taxpayers are paying for are provided and rendered in an efficient and timely manner. And that's a contrast to other governors of both parties and other candidates for governor who have come in with reform agendas. And I think, you know, coming after the last election, there was a certain amount of reform fatigue here and elsewhere. And I think in Indiana, you can't go wrong ever as an elected official by staying with issues that are, we're going to deliver on what the taxpayer wants and we're going to deliver it efficiently.
The smoking age, both caucus, seems all four caucuses agree on that one behind the governor as part of that agenda. So, you know, whether that's a heavy lift, I would guess less of one. Hands-free driving wasn't on those Republican leadership agendas in the legislature. Is that going to face a rocky road in the General Assembly?
I think of what he announced, it's the one that will be more problematic, partly because, you know, that's something that every Hoosier can understand very quickly. Can I hold my phone or not? Am I going to get a ticket if I change my sound, you know, my music on Spotify? Am I, you know? Also, we have to remember, we have Republicans who don't really like putting regulations on people. And, you know, they're small government Republicans, and both of these are new regulations on people.
Yeah. Small government Republicans, if it affects a woman's body, they're all for jumping in on those kinds of regulations. It's always an interesting juxtaposition, I think.
All right, well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question: should Indiana ban Hoosier motorists from using their cell phones while driving unless they're hands-free? A yes or B no. Last week's question: should Indiana raise the minimum legal age to smoke and vape from 18 to 21? 70% of you say yes, 30% of you say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, one item on Governor Holcomb's education agenda for 2020 has been on teachers' minds for most of this year and helped spur protests at the State House. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay reports it is not higher pay.
A new career awareness training requirement for teachers prompted a wave of pushback this year. Thousands of teachers rushed to renew their licenses before the new requirements went into effect this summer. Lawmakers have said they'll consider changing those rules in 2020, but the governor has a suggestion. He wants lawmakers to just make the career awareness training optional for teachers, not required.
I want the school to still have it. It's just I don't believe that the teacher needs to be that first point of contact. I think the school corporation needs to be.
He says schools and community chambers of commerce should be responsible for making those connections instead.
Mike O'Brien, is Eric Holcomb going to run into trouble with members of his own party on this item?
Well, maybe. They just passed these recently, and they all voted for him, right? But they've also heard from teachers and been reactive to that. I think leadership's been reactive to that, both the House and the Senate. This was two of the three planks of really what the teacher rally was all about, kind of on the administrative side and easing some of these administrative burdens. But like Ann just said in the last segment, these are super majorities, so take what she hates and ram it down Democrats' throat, I guess. With these supermajorities, what supermajorities really illuminate and or highlight is that some Republicans do like regulation, right, or do support appropriate, modest regulation in certain areas, and some don't want it ever, right? So in having supermajorities that really control the debate, you just highlight the spectrum of kind of conservative Republican moderate ideology that's in that caucus. And there is this element of, which I think this helps ease, there isn't a large element in these caucuses that's silent, that does have fatigue on education reform, that does want to understand what they're actually doing and voting on better, and not just leading, and not just following the lead, and that's not unusual in other issue areas, yeah. But it's become a real political problem in this area. And so I think the governor's proposals do ease that. I think it does serve what the teachers were asking for. And I think ultimately there's an argument to be made why they're appropriate and that needs to continue, maybe on a voluntary basis, but I think they're going to have success here.
Is this Is this an appropriate response from Eric Holcomb to what teachers have been saying for the last year or so?
Oh, I think it's the only response he can have, to tell you the truth. I think that was this whole idea of the entrepreneurial training was ill thought out in the first place. It was put in the last minute, and nobody knew in those supermajorities what they were voting for. And what's happened now is that you're finally getting teachers to the point where they're getting militant, which is what they're going to have to do in Indiana. Because between the pay being kicked down the road again by Eric Holcomb and the demeaning of the profession of being a teacher that's gone on, starting actually with Mitch Daniels and Tony Bennett and going on down, and Bob Boehning, they think they know better about what goes on in the state, in the classroom, and they think they can regulate it, and they really don't think teachers are important, which is part of the reason that in 2008 we had 17,000 people enrolled in higher education to become teachers. You know what we have now? 8. Okay, we've gone from 17,000 to 8. And a 8, third 000, of
8,000, I presume you're talking about.
8,000, excuse me, thank you.
I'd say this 17, problem's more serious than we might imagine. Yeah.
No, but the point is, it is serious, because you have teachers, a third of the teachers get out of the profession in the first 5 years. And so what we're going to have is a shortage of teachers who are older, who are going to be teaching multiple subjects to much larger classes. And that's all by design on the Republicans since they started this war with teachers.
These professional growth plan requirements were on the agendas of Senate and House Republican leaders, but not like this. They want to tweak them, change them, apply them to some teachers and maybe not others. They haven't really defined what that looks like. Nobody has said, let's just get rid of them, which is essentially what Eric Holcomb is doing here.
Yeah, I mean, by making them voluntary, you're eliminating the requirement. I just think they really need to discuss this more. I mean, the point of licensing professions and renewing them is that you're up to date on all the, you know, current methods and experience and education in your field. I don't know that it's to make sure you're filling the local, you know, manufacturers' jobs. And so while House and Senate Republicans have said repeatedly it's not new, it's in the existing 90 hours, what they're not thinking about is what it means that a teacher can't do. Because if you're doing 15 hours on that, maybe you don't get to go to a really great conference where you learn a new teaching method to get, you know, to connect more with students, to learn a new way to, you know, increase their skills. And so I think it's a fair conversation that they need to have.
Given that Anne mentioned the idea of teachers becoming militant, and if so, I imagine Jim Lucas would be supportive of arming them, but
I think he is, as a matter of fact, in the classroom.
Yeah, that's true. But short of that, the response from teachers certainly over the last year, particularly to things like these requirements, does that back up Eric Holcomb and his plan and what he wants to do in terms of the fight he might have in the legislature over it?
Well, I think they did flex their muscles. We saw that with the rally here a few weeks back on Organization Day. He gets the message. He knows that teachers are concerned with their plight. This is something that probably needed to happen politically. That is, the plug gets pulled on this requirement. What I think is politically savvy about this, if you want to get crass, is for the same lawmakers who might have objected to voting for a complete rejection or reversal, saying that that makes us look silly. We just voted for it. Now it looks like we didn't know what we were doing. Now they can say we're just fine-tuning it. We found that we can still applaud this, champion be champions of this effort about entrepreneurial zeal and what it takes to be develop talent for the workforce of the 21st century. But we understand that some people might.
It's not repealing it.
No, it's not repealing
it.
It's
an option.
And you could argue that every piece of legislation, that's what the legislature does, is fine-tune and revise versus rejecting it. So politically, I think this is
usually you let it go into effect first.
This is, I'm just saying, politically, this it accomplishes the goal and maybe placates teachers to a certain extent.
Well, it placates the teachers to a certain extent, and it doesn't cost him any money, which is really what this is all about.
And it still gives political cover to Republicans in that supermajority who voted for this last year and don't want to look like they were idiots for voting for it now.
Even though they were. Yeah.
A report from the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette's Nikki Kelly, hey, we know her. Yeah, this week shows that Attorney General Curtis Hill has racked up some questionable bills since he took office in 2017. The report reveals that Curtis Hill has opened 8 satellite offices around the state since he became AG, costing taxpayers more than $500,000 in rent annually. That includes one in his hometown of Elkhart. Hill's office told Nikki Kelly he is typically in the statehouse office in Indianapolis every week, but it varies. His staff did not say how many days he works there. No other state office holder has a second office elsewhere. Having an office in Elkhart also allows Hill to count mileage driving between there and Indianapolis as a business expense. There's also an employee, Grant Bascom, who works for both the Attorney General's office and Curtis Hill's campaign, though Hill's office insists never at the same time.
Nikki Kelly, you point out that the sexual misconduct allegations against Curtis Hill haven't seemed to make an impact with, like, ground-level Hoosier Republicans, at least not that we've seen so far. Can something like this do the trick?
Maybe. I mean, time will tell. I mean, I know that I just had been hearing, you know, little things here and there, and so slowly I just built this story and decided maybe it's more of a, instead of a big bombshell, it's more like death by a thousand paper cuts kind of thing. Like, you know, Republicans are very interested in being fiscal stewards of the money, and, you know, whether it's him buying a mobile command center or renovating his office or, you know, sort of manipulating the mileage and having workers go back and forth between campaign and state. I mean, I think there are a lot of questions in there that Republicans should be looking at to see if that's what they want in their attorney general.
Some of the argument over the sexual misconduct allegations against Curtis Hill have been, you know, one thing you'll hear from people who are still willing to support him is, well, we don't know for sure what happened, despite a lot of evidence in one direction. But here, it's this cold, hard numbers, cold, hard evidence that you can look up yourself on the state's contract database and things like that. So does that make this more of a, if you're looking to make an argument against Curtis Hill, does this more compelling in that way?
It probably is a compelling argument for somebody who has the desire and wherewithal to make it an issue on a sustained basis. And not only just say there are X number of satellite offices, but find those things that seem particularly egregious. Think about it in terms of the $800 hammer or the $1,000 toilet seat or whatever it was that famously in Pentagon days, or the golden faucet, shall we
golden
say, but more
faucets.
Appropriately
the
for
reclaimed chandeliers. In
well,
the Attorney
and that's the
office.
Thing. If you have a $70,000 replica of a historic painting, that seems, I would think, stick in the craw of Hoosiers. You can buy a van, great, 15-seat van, have it be your mobile command center, but you really need nearly $700 in, you know, special decals to put your smiling face.
How else would you know it was his?
Well, just put a little stencil or something. So I think it's to the extent that somebody can find the hammer or the toilet seat, and maybe it's those things that you just mentioned, then it becomes something that is shorthand and is more politically potent, I think, than something that can be argued away as simply we want to put government closer to the people, and that's why we're creating satellite offices.
Yeah, I mean, Nikki pointed out that it's not a single big thing, but to all of these collectively, I think, do they resonate with ground-level Republicans? Or, yeah, for instance, perhaps delegates of the Republican convention?
Right.
Just hypothetically?
Well, sure, and I mean, this is at its core about fiscal responsibility. I mean, Mitch Daniels years ago set up purchasing processes inside of state government, in part to prevent this, where one agency couldn't just go off and decide, we're going to go buy a new fleet of cars. No, we have a state fleet of cars that is negotiated on a large basis by the Department of Administration. There's a process for that. And if you've got an elected official that goes, hey, I'm going to check out of that process and go do my own thing with taxpayer money, then that should raise red flags for people, because there's a reason these systems were put in place to begin with, and it was to prevent against waste and abuse.
Obviously, again, none of this is in a vacuum. We have an election next year over the Attorney General. We'll see if Curtis Hill is the nominee for the Republican side. But could something like this be a major election issue?
I don't think there's any question. He's already damaged goods. He's clearly somebody who thinks the rules don't apply to him. And he's thought it all his professional career, whether it's monetarily or whether it's physically, in terms of touching people that don't want to be touched by him. He thinks he's above the rules. And, if that's what the Republican Party, if he is what the Republican Party wants to nominate for that office as the highest legal officer of the state of Indiana, when he thinks the rules the state of Indiana has do not apply to him, I think that's a tough message to sell to voters.
Well, speaking of the race for Attorney General, it has a new contender. Former Evansville Mayor Jonathan Weinzappel announced this week he will seek the Democratic nomination for AG next year.
The Attorney General's race is getting increased attention in the 2020 election cycle after current AG Curtis Hill was accused of sexual misconduct by 5 women. Hill, a Republican, faces potential disciplinary action from the Indiana Supreme Court and a federal lawsuit over the incidents. In a statement, Weinzappel says he is committed to, quote, restoring honor and integrity to the office, The Evansville attorney is a former state lawmaker and Ivy Tech chancellor. State Senator Karen Tallien is also running for the office on the Democrat side, and Indianapolis attorney John Westerkamp will challenge Hill for the nomination at next year's Republican convention.
John Schwanis, does Weinzapfel getting into the race have an impact on Democrats' chances at flipping this office?
Maybe slightly, but I don't think it's the major factor, because you already have a legitimate candidate in the race. Karen Tallien, well-respected
state senator.
State senator. She has the street cred, if you will. In the absence of somebody like that, if it had just been somebody who, a perennial, the Howard, you know, Harold Stassen, if you will, if no one will understand the reference. Somebody,
right.
we understand it. But if somebody just, you know, likes telling the grandkids I was on, you know, hey, I ran for something,
right.
this would be a tremendous boost in the chances of flipping the office. But since you already have a legitimate candidate, here's another legitimate candidate, two different parts of the state represented, certainly one representing below U.S. 40, the other above.
It can't hurt.
It can't hurt. It's simply, I think this is going to be more about what happens on the other side of this race as opposed to what happens on the Democratic side.
Is that precisely
Absolutely.
The point?
Look, Jonathan Weinzapfel, Karen Tallien, very qualified, both of them good candidates that they could put up in any year. But it's secondary to whoever the Republicans nominate. That's really all that matters. Because either way, Democrats are going to put a lot of money into that race because they see this as a very real possibility to get that statewide post. So, I think it's really all about who the Republicans.
And this is not like when we talk about a traditional primary, where maybe you don't really want that primary race to drag money or even attention away from the general election. It's a convention fight here.
It's a convention fight. It can be spirited. And as we always said when we were state chairs, if you had a contested convention, it was good for the dynamics of the entire party.
That's what we say.
Even though you know you don't mean it.
Let me ask you this. John just mentioned that, you know, if there wasn't already a quote-unquote credible candidate, then Weinzapfel entering the race would have a bigger impact on the Democratic side. On the Republican side so far, it's just John Westerkamp going up against Curtis Hill. And Westerkamp, first-time candidate, not really well-known in the party as far as I can tell. Mm-hmm. We don't know what his money-raising capabilities are like yet. We will fairly soon. But does that side need, if you want to see Curtis Hill defeated, does that side need another candidate?
I think John's working hard, but I think you're going to see another candidate come forward shortly.
Who?
Well, we're not breaking news here, Ann.
Why
not? We're just saying things. But I think it is secondary, and Republican delegates need to understand that whoever the Democrats put up is a distant second to whether or not we renominate Curtis Hill. And if your interest is in retaining that seat, if the Republican Party is retaining that seat, the odds are much better if we have a candidate other than Curtis.
Oh. All right.
U.S. House Democrats and organized labor announced this week that they've thrown their support behind an updated trade agreement among the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, known as the USMCA.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, announcing her caucus's support for the USMCA, called it a better deal than the one it's replacing, NAFTA.
But in terms of our work here, it is infinitely better than what was initially proposed by the administration.
Pelosi specifically cited what she sees as improvements on worker protections, environmental provisions, and stripping a measure that would have locked in long-term patent protection for certain pharmaceutical products. Republicans have long pushed House Democrats to get behind the new trade agreement.
Ann Delaney, what took so long?
It took so long for the Republicans to come around to the original proposal the Trump administration put forward was so flawed. Now that they've agreed on the labor components of it and the climate and environmental issues component, now the Democrats can support it. They were, you know, in favor of the notion of the trade agreement, but they wanted those protections put in place, and it took the Republicans a long time to come around, but they did.
Republicans claiming victory here, obviously President Trump negotiating, or his administration negotiating this deal largely. Democrats, House Democrats claiming victory. Is there victory to go around?
Sure, there's victory to go around, but I think there's a far greater victory for President Trump because he has owned this trade message now since a year before the election in 2016. So I think he wins disproportionately on that basis.
All right. Well, finally, as we head into the holiday season, a seemingly annual debate has, of course, once again arisen. Is the famous 1988 action film Die Hard a Christmas movie? Mike O'Brien, is Die Hard a Christmas movie?
Yes, it is a Christmas movie.
That's the correct
answer. It takes place at a Christmas party.
Well, there's no debate. This is just...
It's Christmas Eve. And Die Hard 2 is a Christmas movie because that took place on Christmas Eve.
It needs to be about Christmas for it to be about Christmas.
If you take Christmas out, it doesn't work.
It's a wonderful action movie, but it's not a Christmas movie.
The movie does not
work.
They both
have Bruce Willis, so I don't watch either one.
Die Hard 3 was garbage. Goodness. It wasn't a Christmas movie,
that's
but
terrible.
It was garbage.
All right. Well, that's wow, Indiana Week in Review, and see, you take Christmas out of it,
and
it doesn't
work. It's terrible.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/iwir, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.